This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Peace in Ukraine remains elusive, at least for the time being. First, the unending Western supply of arms continues, led by the U.S. Second, even a temporary truce announced by Russia for Orthodox Christmas for a little over 36 hours, but was rejected by the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky outright, practically within minutes. Meanwhile, the death toll mounts. Economics around the world are suffering. World food supply remains at a fragile state, and the threat of a nuclear war, that still remains a possibility. Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Marcus Papadopoulos. He's a historian, political analyst, and author who joins us from London. Marcus Papadopoulos, welcome. Let's take a look at this Christmas truce that was outright rejected. And it was very interesting in the way that it came out, because we went breaking news with it. But then almost like within 10 minutes or so, it was rejected outright by the presidential aide, I forget his name, but in a tweet. In which it did not go for the offer that Putin had for a 36-hour ceasefire for Orthodox Christmas. What does that say about Ukraine?
Well, first of all, what it demonstrates is that Zelensky is not an independent operator. He is a puppet of the West's, principally of America's and Britain's. Perhaps, and this is just perhaps, deep down, Zelensky regrets having taken on the position as president in the first place. And also, perhaps, he would like to sign a truce with Russia. We witnessed last year evidence emerge that just a few weeks into the Russian military campaign in Ukraine, Zelensky was prepared to sign a truce with the Russian government, but the Americans and the British overruled him. They forbade him from doing so, and therefore he had to keep on fighting against Russia. So it came as no surprise to me that the latest offer by Russia for a truce was rejected. Officially, of course, the truce was rejected by Zelensky, by the Ukrainian government, but in practice, it was rejected by the West. The West is utterly indifferent to the suffering of the Ukrainian population. And of course, the West is indifferent to the suffering of its own people, because the economic war, which is ongoing between the West and Russia, is taking a horrific toll on the lives of ordinary people in, for example, America and Britain. And yet, the Western ruling elites are not only continuing with this war, they are also adding more and more fuel to the war,
sure,
despite the amount of people in Britain and America falling into poverty.
Yeah, so I'm going to ask both of you to put on your military hats in the analytical form and tell us what these moves, militarily speaking, means, which is in the form of weapons. Let me bring in Don DeBar, activist and commentator, who joins us from Austin, New York. Don DeBar, welcome. Season's greetings. Taking a look at the weapons side of the story, the U.S. and its allies. Overall, they are now promising to deliver a variety of armored fighting vehicles to Ukraine. Let's start out with Germany. They're going to supply Mardar fighting vehicles and Leopard tanks. And Germany is very adamant that it wants to do that, but yet it wants also other countries to step up. And we've heard France at this point, who will send light AMX-10RC armored combat vehicles. I mean, I'm mentioning the model names. I don't know what they are, but I think they may, I think they may mean something, because it's like a slow motion grade. We keep getting elevated in terms of the weaponry, and then you have the U.S. weapons, which is called the what? The Bradley fighting vehicles, buddy to Abraham tanks.
Yeah.
So you're having these three countries, at least from what we know, as our guests there said, adding fuel to the fire. What difference will these three countries' weaponry assistance to Ukraine mean?
Yeah, first of all, season's greetings to everyone there also. And I've appreciated working with you over these years, and I look forward to that this coming year as well.
Indeed.
You know, first of all, you know, you're running the names by. They might as well be numbers of bank accounts. This is a self-sustaining, the Holocaust in the making, basically. So self-financing. They buy weapons, quote unquote, but they buy them with our money, and then they, you know, pay the money to themselves, so they get rich in the process. Then they direct, because they have control of the weapons. Also, they direct the weapons at places that will increase their ability to extract value around the world. And whatever happens in the aftermath of that is our problem to deal with. Refugees being driven from the places that are being blown up. A complete fragmentation of everyone else except for the small group of people that have the leash on all of these things. This is what's going on here. In terms of the particular weaponry, I mean, we've been watching weaponry get installed around Russia and China for decades, you know, since 1945, in any event. When I was just listening today to a speech of Henry Wallace made at Madison Square Garden, March 31st, 1947. And this is when the Cold War was really starting to roll. It's around the time the CIA was created, the National Security Act, the Truman Doctrine proclaimed, et cetera, et cetera. And he said very clearly then, and it's been proven, like, I don't know, 30 different data points since at least, that the so-called threat from Russia is really an opening for the U.S. to grab oil for the military. And that's what was happening then, and that's still what's been happening. That they now see the oil and gas wells in Siberia that are potentially and being applied right now to being the fuel tanks as for the engine of growth in Eurasia, China, Russia, the SCO, the bulk of the rest of humanity outside of the golden billion in Europe and the leadership in the United States. That has been a prize that they've wanted to capture since the 19th century. And certainly the details of it were spelled out by Adolf Hitler in 1922 in his jail cell when he was penning his little tome. Right now, the most frightening aspect to me, which looks sort of like the closing move, is the announcement by Fumio Kishida that Japan is going to strengthen its military ties with the United States. Now, Japan is under military occupation for the last 77 years by the United States. Okinawa is a military base and not much else.
Right.
That's the people on the island. And Japan has, you know, gone to war with Russia and China half a dozen times over the last 150 years. They caused huge damage. They killed millions of people in Korea and Japan, mm-hmm. and China, and also much damage to Russia. And this is a country that last month announced that they now want offensive missiles so they can produce a counterstrike.
Sure.
When Article 9 of their Constitution reads, and I'll quote it, that in order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, which is international peace based on justice and order, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be sustained. Uh-huh. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized. This is their constitution, and now they're building a mass. They're going to be the third largest military power in the world at the end of this year.
Indeed.
And that is obviously being targeted at Russia.
Sure.
So, you know, the weapons are being installed across the board.
The thing here is, when we take it, Marcus Papadopoulos, when we take a look at the way that they're upgrading the assistance militarily, it's like a slow motion train, and they're doing it slowly and surely. That in itself must mean, and I'm guessing, I'm asking you, doesn't that mean that what they had was not good enough because the Russian army was prevailing on the ground, so they have to upgrade it? Because every time that they're going for an upgrade, you hear things like what the what Scholz has said. And I'm going to read off the words that he used. Hesitating before, this is a word from the PR article that I got, hesitating before sending powerful weapons for fear of risking direct conflict with Moscow. It's the same thing that the U.S. says. What are they afraid of exactly?
The West and Russia are fighting four wars against each other in relation to Ukraine. The first is a military war. The second is a economic war. The third is a information war. And the fourth is a culture war. Russia is winning the military war and the economic war, while the West is winning the information war. The outcome of the culture war will be decided by whomever emerges victorious in the military war. And I have no doubt whatsoever that Russia will emerge victorious, which takes me to the reason as to why the Western ruling elites have sent so much military hardware to Ukraine that they have depleted their own stockpiles and, as a consequence of that, have jeopardized their own fighting abilities. They have jeopardized their own national security. So it is my submission that the ultimate reason as to why the Western ruling elites have sent vast amounts of money and colossal amounts of military hardware to Ukraine is to preserve Western global hegemony, because the American ruling elites, together with the British ruling elites, understand that if Russia emerges victorious in Ukraine, then either all of Ukraine or most of Ukraine will be absorbed into the Russian Federation, which will enhance even further Russia's status as a superpower, which will mean that an even more powerful Russia will be able to not just block American military adventures wherever they may be in the world, right, but it will also speed up Russia's dismantling of the world order, which has existed since the dissolution of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
So whatever weaponry the Americans and the British and the Germans and the Canadians send to Ukraine, this will not alter the eventual outcome of the war, which will be a Russian victory.
Well, Don DeBar, this is where the, when I asked for you guys to wear your military hat, this is where I think the signal couldn't be stronger, which Medvedev sent out, the deputy chairman of the Security Council of the Russian Federation, where he said, quote, the main gift for the new year, with an ammunition package of Zircon missiles left yesterday for the shores of NATO countries. That's referring to the deployment of a warship with hypersonic cruise missiles, 9 times the speed of sound, and it has a range of 1,000 kilometers. And when we heard Putin, I don't know if you saw the video, but Putin was speaking with a smirk, delivering that message. So we know what these hypersonic missiles are capable of doing. That's a direct message that we can target anywhere, and you can't stop us. Now, are they going to realize that, or are they going to keep this gradual, incremental upgrades of weaponry assistance?
Well, first of all, assuming that Marcus's thesis is correct, I'm guessing mi budem govorit po-rusky. There's a threat.
Don DeBar, we're getting cut off. We're getting on and off. We're getting you on and off here. Let's try to fix that. We have to correct you. Marcus, so that question goes to you. The hypersonic missiles, again, that's a direct message. It couldn't be clearer from Vladimir Putin when he delivered it. So we know that what that is capable of doing, and we know how they, meaning Ukraine, the U.S., NATO countries, et cetera, why don't they have a grasp on that and move more towards perhaps talks, which obviously they're not in that ball field yet?
Well, first of all, when America and Russia are fighting a proxy war against each other, it has the potential to escalate into a direct confrontation between America and Russia, which would, first of all, manifest itself in a conventional war and then quickly escalate into a nuclear war. But at the same time, America and Russia know how to maintain peace between themselves. Whatever you hear the Americans and the Russians saying about one another in public is quite different to what they are saying to each other in private. And we should be exceedingly grateful for that, because the Americans and the Russians, ever since the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, have maintained direct relations between each other. The political and military and the political and military elites of America and Russia talk to each other every single day of the year, year on year. So they know how to maintain peace, because otherwise a war between themselves would see both countries annihilated. And in that situation, they would take the rest of the world with them.
Okay.
But of course, there is always the risk for an accidental war and always the risk of a misinterpretation, which could lead to a war between the two. But I don't think that will happen. But still, you ask, why will the West not sit down and talk, negotiate? Because they know what is at stake. They have to achieve a military victory in Ukraine to preserve Western global hegemony.
Okay.
The Americans do not wish to live in a world where they have to share power with, for example, Russia and also China. They wish to be the sole dominant power, which dictates to every other country in the world.
Right, they like to hold on to that. Maybe that explains why Don DeBar, the U.S. Embassy to Russia, released actually a video, from what we understand, that called for an appeal to the people of Russia. And it went on to use, in this 50-second clip, images of the impact of bombing in Ukraine, that was happening. It's not worthy of you, that we stand in solidarity with each of you who are striving to create a more peaceful future. So we're seeing the U.S. actually want to provoke Russians to, as usual, I must say, based on the track record, for them to turn against Putin and his special military operation. Is that what the U.S. is trying to do here?
Well, Marcus pointed to it, and folks know this. There's an information war that's a component of what the new hybrid war style. I think people in Europe, who, of course, are not able to see it unless they really look for it, should look for a similar piece produced by Russia's propaganda ministry or whatever, that basically it's a 60-second piece. It shows three scenes of a family in the winter of 2021, 2022, and 2023, prospectively. And if you look for it, the question is, what happened to the hamster? Look, there's a war going on. The war is one of acquisition by the West. They moved their material in over the past, again, since 1945, but certainly accelerating since the Obama administration. And the Russians see it. They have satellites, and they know what it means when somebody walks into the house and points a gun at every member of the family. And they decided it's time to fight back, that they had an opportunity to prepare their defenses and their countering offensive capabilities to a point where they could win a war if they had to. They didn't seek the war.
Sure, Don DeBar, I'm really sorry to cut you off because we're fresh out of time. I do apologize for that. But thank you very much, Don DeBar, activist and commentator from Austin, New York. Thank you so much, Don. And Marcus Papadopoulos, a pleasure, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Batagoy and the team, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم واتقوا الذي أمدكم بما تعلمون
And fear he who provided you with that which you know.
أمدكم بأنعام وبنين
Provided you with grazing livestock and children.
وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ
And gardens and springs.
إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ
Indeed, I fear for you the punishment of a terrible day.
Dear listeners, as you were previously with us, we were discussing these verses of chapter Shu'ara. The 132nd one up to 135th. وَاتَّقُوا الَّذِي أَمَدَّكُمْ بِمَا تَعْلَمُونَ Be in awe of him who has succored you with what you know. أَمَدَّكُمْ بِأَنْعَامٍ وَبَنِينَ He has succored you with cattle and children. وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعُيُونَ Gardens, spring. إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ Verily, I fear for you the chastisement of a great day. These verses altogether make the third part of the statement of Hud to the people. This section of the chapter, the section that talks about Prophet Hud exhorting his people to guard themselves against evil, started with the invitation of Prophet to piety. إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ هُود أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ When their brother Hud said to them, Will you not fear Allah? He started by saying that I do not ask any recompense for it. My recompense is only from the Lord of the world. مَا إِنْ أَجْرِيَ إِلَّا عَلَىٰ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ He said. Then he moved on, referring to their faults and their wrong deeds. أَتَبْنُونَ بِكُلِّ رِيعٍ آيَةً تَعْبَثُونَ وَتَتَّخِذُونَ مَصَانِعَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَخْلُدُونَ وَإِذَا بَطَشْتُمْ بَطَشْتُمْ جَبَّارِينَ فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهِ At the end, it said. So they had so many wrongdoings that the Prophet mentioned to them. And now the Prophet somehow tries to stimulate the sense of being thankful of Almighty Allah in them. Haply, they may return toward Allah. So at first he says, Be in awe of him who has succored you with what you know. Everybody returns to himself. What am I being given by the Almighty Allah? Then he goes on and says, أَمَدَّكُمْ بِأَنْعَامٍ وَبَنِينَ Do you not know that these cattle, these banin and children you are given are the blessings of the Almighty Allah? وَجَنَّاتٍ وَعَيُونَ Do you forget all these gardens and springs you are given? Don't you recognize that you do not have any deficiency or inconvenience in your lives? How can you forget the bestower of all these bounties? Then he states the last page of his words and somehow threatens and warns them with the divine retribution when he says, إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ Verily, I fear for you the chastisement of a great day. It will be a day when you will see by your own eyes the consequence of all those cruelties, all those injustice, pride, arrogance, and worshipping low desires, sexuality, and alienation with Allah. I fear for you. Inni akhafu alaykum, the Prophet says.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran
by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So the Prophet says, somehow threatening them, warning them with the divine retribution, إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ. I fear for you the chastisement of a great day. The Quranic phrase, يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ, a great day, is usually applied for the hereafter day, which is great from any dimension, but it has sometimes been used in the verses of the Holy Quran for the harsh and terrible days that some nations had, as the story of Shu'aib mentioned in this very surah. We are informed that Allah punished the people of Shu'aib with that lightning that emerged from the piece of cloud, after they showed obstinacy for accepting the truth. And that day was a great day, يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ. It says, verily, it was a chastisement of a grievous day. So, the phrase يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ mentioned in this verse may refer to the day when the arrogant ones of the Ad people encountered the painful punishment of instructive wind. The evidence of this meaning is the statement of their retribution in a few verses later that we will, God willing, mention. It may also refer to the retribution of hereafter day, or to both of these chastisements, whose day is very great. At the end, let us have a look at one tradition from the Messenger of Almighty Allah that says, he who tortures people in the world severely will have the worst punishment among people with Allah on the hereafter day. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, Take care.
Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
St. Pancras Station, one of London's biggest and busiest. But not today. A 48-hour strike by train drivers, preceded by another 48-hour walkout by other rail workers, have meant travel misery for thousands. The dispute between ASLEF and the RMT Rail Workers Union on the one hand, and the employer Network Rail and train operating companies on the other, is largely over pay and the impact of inflation on workers' wages. But disagreements have kept a deal elusive for months.
Well, we want to hear movement on the issue about some of the conditions they've put down in Network Rail. That's a restructuring of all our members' terms and conditions. And it's a similar recipe in the train operating companies. They've gone for a thing called driver-only operation, which we think is extremely unhelpful. We can't accept that. And, of course, we'd like an improvement in the pay offers.
Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has so far refused to meet with the unions to try and hammer out a deal and has instead vowed to get tough on the strikes. His government is also accused of trying to turn public opinion against the strikers. But there's no sign of that happening yet.
I think workers are well within their rights to demand at least living wages to be kept in line with inflation. So, yeah, I'm fully supportive of this.
I really sympathise. I think they're right. So I'm not mad. It's inconvenient.
The UK economy is experiencing the combined effects of Brexit, the war in Ukraine, and its effect on energy costs, as well as inflationary pressure on the post-pandemic recovery. And rail workers are not the only ones complaining.
ASLEF and the RMT are two of the UK's most powerful unions, able to bring their railway service to a standstill during industrial disputes. And the concerns they have been raising about the difference between people's pay packets and the cost of living at the moment are shared by many different industries and professions.
Nurses, ambulance drivers, teachers, postal workers, driving examiners and the like all have pay deals with the government in the pipelines and are likely to be offered less than the rate of inflation. And that means the UK's winter of discontent is likely to drag on. Saeed Pereza, London.
Veteran Iranian politicians were present alongside foreign activists, scholars, and researchers on the second and final day of the first international conference on Martyr Soleimani's School of Thought. Panel discussions shed light on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's life and legacy.
You have to live with people like Martyr Soleimani to understand why they chose that certain lifestyle. Not only that, but even more important is how they choose to die. This makes people like Martyr Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Martyr Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Martyr Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against the ban on hijab. He was inspired by Martyr Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Martyr Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Martyr Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight 3 points. One deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, to create networks of like-minded people. He was a religious man, he was an ethical man. He was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Historic electoral breakdowns in the United States continue to multiply. For the first time in 100 years, Congress has failed to immediately elect a speaker for the House of Representatives, which is the nation's number three post following the vice president. After 2 days and more than a handful of votes, a group of around 20 so-called Trumpist lawmakers continue to reject the mainstream Republican, Kevin McCarthy. An irony is that Donald Trump urged Republicans to unite behind McCarthy, a reflection of the deep divisions in a politically reconfigured nation.
It's kind of the Republican establishment not knowing how to deal with the monster that both the corporate and right-wing media systems have kind of created over the last kind of period, the emergence of Trump as a political figure and then the rise of Trumpism. It's really kind of gotten away from at least the establishment Republicans that would very much like to be able to wash their hands of January 6th, and can't.
The failure to choose a speaker reduces Congress' total standstill, with legislation impossible. The only legal solution is for someone to finally win a majority. In 1855, that took 2 months and 133 rounds of voting. The Republican red wave of 2022 only produced such a narrow midterm victory that even a small group of their lawmakers can exert a huge amount of influence. The hardline stance of the dissenting Republicans is actually what many Democrat supporters expected out of the so-called squad of alleged progressives after their party's even narrower blue wave win in 2020.
Very much kind of putting to shame the squad and showing that being a unified bloc, even if you're a minority, if you take a fighting stance and you don't go along to get along, you can fight for meaningful wins. Unfortunately, now we have an example from the right.
The caucus of dissenters is often described as far right, while others note that their nominee for speaker is an African American and that their demands include more transparency in legislation and less power for congressional leaders. Many expected that a divided Congress would produce squabbles and political stagnation, but perhaps not this quickly. The electoral dysfunction at the federal level continues to embarrass and perhaps discredit democracy with American characteristics. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansar Allah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The start of the new year has brought bad news for the Italians. The average price of unleaded petrol at the pump in Italy has once again surged, increasing by over 15 cents. That is about 15% more compared to December 31st. The latest hike is due to the expiration of measures introduced in May to mitigate the nefarious effects on Italy's economy of an exceptionally high increase in the cost of energy that followed the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The price of unleaded petrol stands now at about 1.8 euros per litre, while that of diesel has reached almost 2 euros.
The increase in fuel costs at the turn of the new year is mainly due to the reinstatement of the full rates of excise duty and VAT on petrol, diesel and LPG that the former government led by Mario Draghi introduced last year. The spike is also due to the higher cost of mixing biofuels with petrol and diesel as required by the law.
Experts fear fuel prices might even increase further after February the 5th, when a European Union ban on Russian oil product imports kicks in as part of sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This follows a ban on Russian crude that took effect in December.
With a population of 59 million and about 40 million circulating vehicles, it is easy to understand how vital is the role of road transport in Italy. It accounts for three-quarters of all land transportation of goods. It goes without saying that the country's rising fuel costs for both petrol and diesel will have dreadful consequences for medium and small businesses and for everyday people.
While wages remain the same, fuel in general, energy costs keep rising. I'm very worried. Too much uncertainty.
What worries me the most is the fact that wages remain unchanged while the cost of living is skyrocketing. I have four kids and we are struggling to make ends meet.
Higher fuel prices further swell living costs for people in Italy, as electricity and gas bills have increased by about 300% since September. Italy was expecting to raise almost 10 billion euros from measures targeting the super profits made by energy companies that benefited from the surge in oil and gas prices. So far, only one quarter of that amount has been paid to the tax office. Max Civili, Rome.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indict on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next. All bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, But that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics, you know, and prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away aged 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
Rabbana.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very important question. And that question is about a very sensitive topic. That topic is about taqlid and imitation of a mujtahid and an expert in matters of faith. Taqlid is not only a topic which, you know, people object to, normal people object to. So, you know, taqlid is not only a subject which was a point of contention amongst people, normal people. It is also something which a group of scholars, right, in the history of tashayyu and Islam have called into question. In the history of Islamic jurisprudence and Islamic thought and Shiite thought, there was a group of scholars, right, who were known as the Akhbaris, right, the Akhbaris. And, you know, these people, they called into question the legitimacy of, actually ijtihad itself, right? And that, you know, that a human being could go and exercise his power of reason and come to a conclusion regarding matters of faith. And then, you know, people should follow him, right? So this is a subject which, a lot of people, normal people call into question, but also, even a group of scholars called it into question, right? And of course, we want with the reservation that this is a subject that should be examined in a scholarly way in its own proper place, in the Sunni discussions, If we want to give a very, cursory answer, we can say that we have numerous hadiths, right, regarding the necessity of following a religious expert. Like, for example, we have one hadith, a very famous hadith, which has been passed down to us. So we have numerous hadiths. Right, one of which is the following hadith. We have a hadith in which the imam says that if there is a faqih, if there is a jurisprudent who protects his soul from sin, protects his religion, follows his master, right, and goes against his desires, right, the people, the normal people, the common people, they should follow him in matters of faith. Right? This is clearly... It's very clear and apparently legitimizes, right, the exercise of ijtihad and also the permissibility of people following a mujtahid in matters of faith. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the legitimacy of taqlid. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program, The Key, on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight. Majority of U.S. Republicans are against the candidacy of former President Donald Trump in the presidential elections in 2024. Donald Trump is the only president in the history of the United States who has been impeached twice on charges of abuse of power, obstruction of law, and inciting supporters to attack Congress on 6th of January 2021. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue.